team has long record of intentionally targeting journalists, a tactic used to silence those exposing its war crimes and human rights violations. In the past 17 months, 208 journalists have been killed by Israeli occupation forces. Assassination of journalist Hossam Shabat is the latest crime.
Hossam was wearing his press hamlet and vest committing to the safety and journalism standards. However, he was hit by an Israeli missile. Hussam was documenting the Israeli bombing and crimes against his people. That's why he got killed. Surely, as journalists, we appeal to the international community to stop the killing of the journalists.
Known for his relentless efforts to expose Israeli war crimes, genocide, and human rights abuses perpetrated against the Palestinian people, Shabat's killing underscores a disturbing pattern of violence directed towards the press by the Israeli forces to mute any voice calling for justice.
The Israeli occupation deliberately targets the journalists in Gaza since the beginning of the war. Hussam and Mohamed Mansi were killed on the same day, mounting the journalists' death toll to 208. That is an additional proof that the Israeli regime does deliberately and systematically kill the journalists. Prior to his assassination, Hossam was threatened by the Israeli army.
I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavements, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side. That were his last words on X. Shabat's assassination is a stark reminder that the Israeli regime continues to be engaged in a genocidal campaign against the Palestinians, one that seeks not only to annihilate their bodies, but also to erase their voices. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
The Israeli regime has once again given its green light to a plan that strengthens its grip on the occupied West Bank. The latest move, orchestrated by far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, grants independent status to 13 settler neighborhoods, making them eligible for direct infrastructure and financial support. Analysts warn that this will accelerate land confiscation, allowing the regime to deepen its settlement enterprise at the expense of Palestinian communities.
Annexation is a process, and that's what's happening, like not now. And one of the main junctions for that is in 2020, when that time Trump was in power and when they announced the annexation plan officially. This is the first time that they announced a map and they announced about the annexation plan. From there, they started the demolition of the Palestinian communities, taking more and more lands. And also, when this fascist government came to the power, they accelerated this.
For 3 years, the Israeli regime has allocated huge resources to push towards more land grip in Area C. Almost $3 billion U.S. dollars were apportioned to make the lives of the settlers easier in the West Bank's stolen lands.
All the settlements had been established in the Area C in the West Bank. Area C, 62% of the West Bank, which all the Palestinian resources there, water resources, agricultural land, everything for the Palestinians. What's been left for the Palestinians out of Area C is Area A and B, which is the built-up area. There's nothing to live on. What they are trying to do is just to make out of the West Bank another two or three even more Gaza strips in the West Bank, separated cantons that are isolated from each other without any resources, depending totally on Israel and under mercy of their military and settlers.
The de facto situation which the regime is imposing every day in the West Bank aims, according to analysts, to expel Palestinians forcibly or willfully.
Israel is expanding settlement outposts, granting them local councils and huge budgets. The upcoming budget includes massive funds for settlement growth, first legalizing outposts, then developing them into full-scale cities. Meanwhile, settler violence targets Palestinian towns, isolating communities and confining them to segregated areas. The goal is clear: make life unbearable for Palestinians, forcing them toward displacement.
Israel has been expanding settlement despite global condemnations,
The new separation plan effectively legalizes further land grabs, making it easier to build and connect settlements while cutting off Palestinian areas. Israel's settlement expansion continues to reshape the West Bank's landscape, making a future Palestine state increasingly unviable. As Palestinian communities face ongoing land seizures, the world remains largely silent. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
March 25th, 2015, the day when the Saudi-led coalition launched a military campaign in Yemen to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, an ally of Saudi Arabia. The campaign aimed to push the Ansarullah movement back to Sada in northern Yemen as well. With support from the United States, the coalition also sought to establish a buffer zone between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
When the Saudi-led aggression against the Yemeni people began in 2015, it had no clear objectives. However, when the aggressors realized they were entangled in this war, they declared an official goal through a meeting at the United Nations Security Council and Resolution 2216, which was to reinstate Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. Yet they failed to achieve this goal, along with all the objectives they had set for their coalition.
The United Nations estimates that the war in Yemen has killed 337,000 people by the end of 2021. The deaths include those caused by both conflict and indirect causes, such as hunger and preventable diseases. According to UN officials, the indirect causes were to blame for the majority of the deaths, as the Saudi-led coalition maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, a country dependent on international aid to meet its basic needs, even prior to the war.
As the 10th anniversary of the aggression against Yemen arrives, the blockade continues to severely impact the healthcare sector, causing immense suffering due to the ongoing restrictions on medical supplies. During the years of aggression, airstrikes have targeted 55% of the healthcare sector, rendering 98% of medical equipment non-operational, as we have been unable to repair them or secure spare parts.
The years-long war also devastated other key infrastructure, including airports. The airstrikes, coupled with the crippling blockade, created what the United Nations called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, leaving millions struggling for basic necessities.
There have been many tragedies over the past 10 years of the blockade, both in humanitarian terms and in material losses. On the humanitarian side, there have been significant losses of lives, especially among patients with critical illnesses who needed to travel for treatment but were prevented due to the airport closure. In addition, many students were unable to continue their studies, and tourism came to a complete halt, inflicting severe losses on the national economy.
Archaeological sites were not safe from attacks either. According to a 2019 report by the UN's cultural agency UNESCO, Yemeni cultural heritage sites were heavily affected, mostly through collateral damage. Following years of deaths and destruction, a ceasefire was agreed on April 2, 2022, under UN sponsorship. But while the fighting has largely stopped, Yemen's economic crisis continues, and the struggle to rebuild remains an uphill battle.
Even with a ceasefire in place, the scars of war are still visible across Yemen. Families who lost everything now face the challenge of rebuilding their lives amid an economic crisis. For many Yemenis, the road to recovery is far from over. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, the last haven for those wounded or injured by the Israeli attacks to survive. This place has been turned into blackened ruin as it was targeted last night by the Israeli occupation. At least one airstrike was launched here, destroying this department that was filled with dozens of the patients and the wounded Palestinians who were fighting for their lives. And as the place was set on fire following the attacks, all the patients and the medical crews here were in a state of panic and just rushing to evacuate instantly but unfortunately 10 of them, 8 were injured and 2 were killed by this attack, including a 16-year-old child. This place, despite being inside the heart of the Nasser Medical Complex, was deliberately targeted by the Israeli occupation, turning it into ruins.
Hospitals and medical personnel are protected under international and humanitarian law. However, the occupation knows no boundaries or laws. It deliberately targeted this department, rendering it out of service after it had caused the collapse of the medical sector across the Gaza Strip. 2 people were killed, and the rooms in this department, including the oxygen station, were destroyed. This is the only male surgical department here, and now we are forced to treat the remaining wounded, who are now injured for the second time, in inadequate and unsuitable conditions. This is a war crime, and we urge the international community to hold the occupation accountable and prevent such atrocities.
Now, this department is officially out of service. All the patients that were here last night and survived the attack were moved by the medical crews here to other facilities and departments here inside the hospital, where they are now uncertain where exactly and how to receive treatment, because they did survive the previous attacks by the occupation, and now they were targeted again, making them sure that no place is safe in Gaza. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
The Israeli bombardment has decimated educational institutions across Gaza and the occupied West Bank, making it nearly impossible for Palestinian students to pursue their studies. Schools and universities have turned to rubble, leaving thousands in despair. But for some, hope still shines. 7 Palestinian students have reached Pakistan to continue their education, with more expected soon. For Palestinian students, education is not just about degrees. It's about survival. Despite losing their homes and universities, they refuse to let the Israeli war define their future. Al-Khidmat Foundation has stepped forward, taking full responsibility for their education and living expenses. These students will enroll in different disciplines in Pakistani universities, ensuring that war does not rob them of their dreams.
We are from Gaza. And since the war, Israeli war in Gaza, all the universities are distracted and stop studying, and this will stop the educational process in Gaza. So we are taking this choice to go to Pakistan to continue our studies there.
I'm a teacher assistant at the university. I have studied 5 years of computer engineering at the university, and I came here to continue my studying master degree at data science at university for data science.
This isn't the first time Pakistan has opened its door to Palestinian students. Last year, Palestinian medical students arrived in Lahore, reflecting the resilience of a generation fighting for its future.
We believe education is the strongest form of resistance. We stand with our Palestinian brothers and will ensure they get the education they deserve.
As Israeli aggression continues, their right to education remains under attack in Palestine. But these students prove that no amount of destruction can erase their will to learn. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
We will never be silent!
Students at prestigious Georgetown University protested in defense of the latest academic detained and scheduled for deportation by the administration of Donald Trump, Badr Khan Suri, their professor at the school's Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding.
One,
We are demanding the release of Dr. Suri. Two, we are demanding that this university become a sanctuary campus, which means the university must not allow ICE, DHS, and MPD onto campus, and the university must not aid in the arrest and deportation of students. And three, we are demanding complete divestment from entities complicit in the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Hundreds of protesters have been arrested recently across the United States at rallies for deported scholars, many for the most notorious deportation case, that of Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia University in New York City. Both Suri and Khalil were legal U.S. residents, married to American citizens, and never charged with breaking any laws. Unlike Khalil, Suri was not involved in political activism, but was still charged with allegedly spreading pro-Hamas propaganda.
One academic's deportation read, quote, "Your presence or activities in the United States would have adverse consequences for the foreign policy of the United States." The question is, adverse for whom?
We can see through the military-industrial complex, the one that is making the ruling class in this country millions, billions of dollars, that if that was to be threatened, if Palestine was to be liberated, if the masses of this country actually are educated on what's happening and not being fed the U.S. propaganda around what we're seeing in the Middle East, it would be not detrimental to the U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. Domestic policy as well, but just more so detrimental to these people's pockets.
The United States is currently undergoing a lengthy anti-Palestinian witch hunt, which can only be compared to the anti-socialist Red Scares from 1917 to 1920, and then again from 1947 to 1957.
It hasn't just started with Donald Trump. You know, it's gotten much worse, but there was already, you know, efforts on campus to repress pro-Palestinian speech. It's never been truly welcomed as free speech, even before Donald Trump.
A federal judge just blocked the deportation of Suri, but refused to release him back to his wife and three young children, and Suri remains in jail. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth. bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Good evening. China remains the main threat to the United States globally, but of increasing concern is its closer cooperation with Russia, Iran, and North Korea, said an annual U.S. intelligence report released Tuesday. China's rise in all areas of power has been identified for years by the U.S. as its main threat and was behind Barack Obama's strategic Asia-Pacific pivot. That is the American perspective, but China sees its rise rooted in its commitment to peaceful development, international cooperation, and mutual benefit. Yet it faces accusations that exaggerate its intentions and disregard its respect for sovereignty and stability of other countries, particularly in the Asia-Pacific region. Welcome to Spotlight. I am Bahman Roy, your host. Let us begin with a short report.
China and the United States, two world powers locked in escalating tensions. The rivalry between Beijing and Washington continues to rise, from economic sanctions and import tariffs to military maneuvers and technological competition. The stakes are higher than ever. The economic standoff, which began in 2018 under President Donald Trump, was marked by waves of import tariffs and retaliatory measures. Back then, Trump accused China of unfair trade practices and intellectual property theft. Beijing responded with rising tariffs on U.S. goods. The tit-for-tat move escalated following Trump's second-term inauguration, with the U.S. imposing additional tariffs on Chinese goods just days into his new term. China retaliated with levies on a number of U.S. products, including coal and agricultural ones. By March, the conflict intensified further, targeting a broader range of imports. Beyond tariffs, the U.S. has ramped up its pressure campaign to contain China's power rise through sanctions. In the latest attempt, Washington blacklisted dozens of Chinese entities, including technology firms, aiming to restrict Beijing's development of high-performance computing capabilities. The U.S. government justified the move by citing national security and foreign policy concerns. China, however, accused Washington of weaponizing trade and technology in a typical act of hegemonism.
We urge the U.S. to stop generalizing the concept of national security and stop abusing all kinds of sanction lists to unreasonably suppress Chinese enterprises.
Tensions, however, have been extending far beyond trade. A recent U.S. intelligence report has identified China as, quote, the most comprehensive and robust military and cyber threat to American national security. The report, which compiles assessments from U.S. intelligence agencies, warns of Beijing's ability to hit the U.S. with conventional weapons, compromise U.S. infrastructure through cyber attacks, target assets in space, and challenge America's dominance in artificial intelligence. Beijing has reacted to the report, calling it biased, and accused Washington of exaggerating the China threat.
We advise the U.S. not to use its own hegemonic logic to mirror China, not to view China-U.S. relations with outdated Cold War thinking, not to contain and suppress China in the name of strategic competition, and not to exaggerate the China threat.
Beijing has also urged Washington to scale back its military presence in the South China Sea and halt its support for Taiwan, which China considers part of its sovereign territory. The report also shows that Washington has grown increasingly uneasy about China's deepening ties with its allies, including key U.S. adversaries such as Russia and Iran. As the two powers maneuver for influence across the globe, the tension between them is no longer a bilateral affair. It has become a global chess match with implications for every corner of the world. How will these tensions shape the future of international relations? Only time will tell.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, joining us from Bradenton, U.S. And Daniel Patrick Wells, geopolitical analyst and political commentator, joining us from Boston, also from the U.S. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the program. I'm going to start my very first question with you, Larry. How does China's growing military and economic power challenge the United States' global power?
Well, it's a threat that the United States has created. Look, if I walk up to you and I start poking you in the chest, and then I put hands on your wife, and you punch me back, and then the person punched says, I've been attacked unjustly. Well, that's not true. And that's exactly what's been going on here. You know, we can write, I was going to propose writing the book, Chinese Overseas Military Adventures. The problem was it'd only be about a chapter long, because the only time that China has actually done any kind of military activity outside of its territorial boundaries was back in 1979 when it fought Vietnam on behalf because of Vietnam's war with Cambodia. So the fact of the matter is, it's not China that's been the military expansionist. It's not China that has 700 plus military bases around the world. It's not China that basically started a war with Libya and then invaded Iraq and invaded Afghanistan and started a war with Syria. That's not China, that's the United States. So what we're engaged here with is the United States is doing a form of what the psychologists call projection. They're assigning to China the blame for what we're doing. And China's listened, you know, there was just about a year ago that a U.S. admiral, the deputy commander, I believe, in Indo-PACOM, the segment of the U.S. military responsible for the Asia-Pacific region, said openly that, hey, we're going to be at war with China by the end of 2025. Well, if you're Chinese leaders, particularly intelligence officials and military leaders, you have to take that as a serious threat and prepare accordingly. And so when China prepares in response to the bellicose rhetoric of the United States, China is then blamed, oh, China is trying to take over the world. It's just a lie.
Right. I'm going to ask the same question to Daniel. Daniel, how do you think this, you know, the Chinese, if I can call it hegemony, or if the Chinese influence over the world. How is it going to affect the American power and influence? How can they not work together for a shared objective, for example?
Well, I love what Larry said. I can't really answer or add to it too much. But it is important to look at what the U.S. has done in that the psychological example that he uses, that they're accusing, like every sociopath, accusing its greatest victim of its own crimes. And to say, I think what you asked was, don't these work together, right? First of all, to bring economies up, to bring people up, to focus on development, yes, that is a universal objective that you can say is a common purpose of all nations, corporations, human beings on Earth. But if your point is to be at the top of the pile, that's like if your only objective is playing King of the Hill, then you're only looking at who to kick down, who's climbing up too fast. So what China is doing wrong is actually playing at the same game, which is not to take over, but to develop. And this is a thing that China has set, you know, one of the interesting things, you're dealing with the Trump administration, which is a flash in the pan, really, except for its embrace of long-term strategy of keeping the U.S. in the driver's seat and in the position of control over all the other countries in the world. But this thing of being, you know, say, long-term planning, right? This is since the Sino-Soviet split. This is Nixon and the reestablishment of relations with the West is a blink of an eye ago for China. I wish the U.S. could think in the same way. That's what they're saying. Don't think in these these Cold War hegemonic logic, but think in longer terms. This is how the world works, and we are doing something that they pledged to do 50, 70 years ago, is to beat them at their own game, not because they want to win the game, but because if you stay out of foreign affairs, like they have remarkably done, compared to the Soviet Union, and obviously specifically compared to the U.S., and used every other variable to climb up and take over the position, say in AI and chip development, and even in military development, then you really are a threat. If you change the rhetoric a little bit, you really are a threat because you're doing it right. And this is, of course, whether they say it or not, this is the problem. The problem with China is it's too good. You can't say that because you sound like a toddler or something. But that is why. That is what Ukraine is about. That is what Libya is about. That is what putting typhoons in Philippines is about, trying to muscle in on AUKUS or the Strait of Taiwan. All of that is to counter a real competitor, and to do it unfairly and to cheat at it if you can, because that's how you've got where you are if you're the U.S. and it works. And if you can cheat them right, and beat them, then that's a good strategy.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
but I'm going to get back onto the technological side that you just mentioned and also the issue of Taiwan. But I'm going to talk to Larry right now. You are a former CIA analyst. Tell me, you know, what are the implications of China's alignment with the likes of Russia, Iran, and North Korea for the model of international stability that is proposed by the U.S., the American model?
Well, it depends on which assumptions you make and where you sit. The United States, well, the Trump administration right now, at the senior levels, as well as, you know, most pundits that deal with Asia, as well as the think tanks that populate the United States, all believe that there's no way that Russia and China can have any kind of real, lasting, long-term relationship. I mean, good God, they're those stinky Chinese. They're, you know, ugh, yellow and ugh. Because the Russians are like us, racially pure. I mean, that's the subterfuge to this. And they really believe that they can split Russia off China. And it's so cynical because this is like we're telling them to break up with their partner so that we can rape them. You know, we're going to rape Russia first, and then we'll deal with China. I was 3 weeks ago, I was had a chance to interview Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, just myself and two other individuals. And I specifically asked him about this. And he answered in a way that Daniel will appreciate because he repeated the point that Daniel was making. He goes, you know, we've got a history with China, and it hasn't always necessarily been good, but we have a relationship now that's founded on mutual respect. It's economic, it's political, it's military. But he says the Chinese have a much longer time horizon. And he put his hand up like this. They've got a much longer view of things than we do. But he says this is a genuine relationship, and we recognize that we cannot put ourselves in a position where we're going to be beholden or vulnerable to Western economic control. So very clear on that point that Russia and China have entered into a relationship, and this isn't recent, because notice that starting in 2019, Russia and China began conducting annual joint naval military exercises with Iran. And those exercises started in 2019, and the fact that that was when it was first executed, in March of 2019, that means the planning for it started no later than 2018 and most likely started in 2017. So basically, we're saying for the last 8 years, Russia, China, and Iran have been talking about the need for an economic realignment that also entails military support. And one of the reasons for that is what Russia's proposing is a north-south highway or railway that's going to extend from the port cities in southern Iran and will run up through Azerbaijan into Russia. This way, they circumvent all the madness in the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, and Russia is no longer dependent upon the kind of influence that the West exercises there. So that's one of the big things that's at play here.
Right. Thank you, Larry. I'm going to ask Daniel about the Taiwan issue between the two countries. Well, the U.S. presidents, the U.S. governments tend to always complain about China's coercive pressure on Taiwan. But at the same time, the Chinese government always says that this is intervention in our internal affairs. So how is this issue going to overshadow the future of the relations between the two countries?
Well, I mean, overshadowing is with all due respect, I think is the wrong word to use, because it's essential. That's the only actual defense mechanism. Remember my thing about the toddlers, right? If that's the only argument you have, you start with it. It's like saying the Republic of Texas, you know, is being bullied by the U.S. Or, I mean, you can't even make up an anecdote as ridiculous as this. You see slippage in the commitment to the One China policy that helped bring China into the UN, into the global atmosphere in general. And there's some language changes on the website. I didn't pay attention to the actual details, but something is slipping in terms of towing the line that they've always said since then, which is that there is one China, and Taiwan is part of China. Now, if you try to interject as using that to split China, then you obviously have given up on the overall idea, which makes your position completely untenable. You cannot have a relationship with China in the current, meaning the last 70 years, without accepting that as the premise. And once you poke under that skin, it is completely, it's like in a personal relationship, it's completely obnoxious. We're not talking about that. Hey, stop that. We're not talking, I told you, that's off the table. That's always been off the table. Don't keep telling us that. And what, again, as Larry pointed out well, too, is that the arguments coming against it are actually the arguments that you would put for it. They say China is making Taiwan an issue or a problem. They're being coercive. They're being subversive. I love when they use that language. Like nothing could fit the U.S. perspective better than that, but it's always the other person who's being coercive and subversive. And they're trying to use Taiwan when all they're doing is exactly what they said from the beginning. Taiwan is China. And you cannot fund the opposition. Small group military joint exercises that are, you know, only inches from mainland China. You know, I mean, it's insane that the U.S. tries to flip it like that. But they are going to continue to use Taiwan. And they will fail because they are failing in the general sense, like we have been covering so far. They're losing the big game, and these are tiny pieces on the chessboard, and they're going to lose those too.
Right, Larry, America, on the other hand, is reinforcing its presence in the South China Sea area. What justifies that?
The American dynasties are losing their shirt in Ukraine. You know, we just had a press report here in the last 4 hours out of the New York Post about four American soldiers that died in Lithuania or Latvia, supposedly. I guarantee they were killed in Ukraine, and they're using the cover to Latvia or Lithuania to cover that. So the overall sentiment is, you know, we can't defeat Russia, so therefore we better move on to get prepared to defeat China. Which is, it's insane. It's a crazy position. But I guess it's perceived that has the best, let's call it, economic prospects for the military-industrial complex, which has been profiting from the war in Ukraine and now is looking to profit from a buildup to a non-existent military threat from China, because China's not planning to attack anybody. China's taking defensive measures that are provoked by us, and in return, we get to pretend that they're going to attack us, which then allows us to say, hey, man, that defense budget, $1 trillion's not enough. Let's kick it up to $1.2 trillion. We're gonna keep Western money overseas and impoverishing the American people.
Right. Daniel, China always claims right now that the U.S. is weaponizing trade and financial affairs to inflict hits on this country, and they're just reacting to what they are seeing from the American side. Your take on that?
I think that's exactly right. You know, that is, I love listening to the, you know, both the Chinese and the Russian perspectives, because it's a breath of fresh air in some sense. Not that I have to agree with it, but it is just the bare bones truth. All they're doing is doing what they're doing. And the Americans are then using it, weaponizing it, exactly as they said. And Guo Xiaoqun, the spokesperson for the foreign ministry, who said that this is illegal. This is using, you can't use sanctions and our foreign policy as a means to justify what you're calling economic decisions, because they're not. And that is what the U.S. has used going back, at least to Kissinger. One of the things about realpolitik is that Kissinger was using both truth, and he wasn't dealing with a Bush league, no pun intended, of used car salesmen who knew how to make this deal by dealing with reality and not just browbeating people. You can't win the argument or the deal that way. It's not a used car. Shuttle diplomacy is not about selling real estate.
Right, gentlemen, thank you so much. I wanted this conversation to go on for an hour, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to end this. Thank you so much for your presence once again. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, joining us from Bradenton, U.S., and Daniel Patrick Wells, geopolitical analyst and political commentator, joining us from Boston, also from the U.S. And thank you so much for staying with us on another Spotlight. We'll see you back tomorrow.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. We're going to talk about famous reciters of the Quran in this segment. One of the famous Egyptian reciters is Sheikh Ahmad Amir. He was born in 1927 in the golden age of Quran recitation in Egypt. Many great reciters were born in the 1920s, such as Sheikh Minshawi, Abdul Basit, Bahtimi, Shu'aisha, Hamdi Zamil, and many other reciters. When he was 11 years old, he memorized the whole Quran. At a very young age, he was called a sheikh because he was so good at reciting the Quran. He joined the Egyptian radio in 1963, and the first country that he traveled to recite the Quran was Sudan. He also traveled to many other countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran. He recited the Quran in 2004 in the presence of the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And Ayatollah Khamenei very much liked his recitation. Again, in 2013, he was invited to Iran to participate as a referee in the Quran competition held in Iran. He recited Surah Yunus, verses 107 to 109, the recitation that we're about to listen to right now. Sheikh Ahmad Amir passed away in 2016 at the age of 89. May Allah bless him and reward him. Now let's listen to Surah Yunus, verses 107 to 109 by Sheikh Ahmad Amir. Let's enjoy this
recitation. فلا كاشف له إلا هو الله وإن يردك بخير فلا رد لفضله
ما شاء الله
حياك الله يا أستاذ
يصيب به من يشاء من عباده وهو الغفور الرحيم قل يا فمن اهتدى فإنما يهتدي لنفسه ومن ضل فإنما يضل عليها وما
And if Allah should touch you with adversity, there is no remover of it except Him. And if He intends for you good, then there is no repeller of His bounty. He causes it to reach whom He wills of His servants, and He is the forgiving, the merciful. Say, O mankind, the truth has come to you from your Lord, so whoever is guided is only guided for the benefit of his soul, and whoever goes astray only goes astray in violation against it, and I am not over you a manager. And follow what is revealed to you, O Muhammad, and be patient until Allah will judge, and He is the best of judges.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, calls for mass rallies across Iran to mark the International Quds Day amid the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Speaking on the occasion of Quds Day, Yemen's Ansarullah leader calls on all Arab nations to take practical measures to thwart Israel's expansionist ambitions. And also coming up, the U.N. says Gaza is facing the longest period it has been without any supplies, as no humanitarian aid has entered for over 3 weeks.
Hello and welcome to your world news.